when we first started debating the war resolution, you could probably put all of the opponents in a telephone booth.
A bullet costs money that should be going into child care. Oh, our weaponry costs money that should be benefiting our communities and our children's lives.
Do you think George Bush really just wants to fatten his pockets with oil money on the backs of women and children of Iraq?
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, January 22nd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Reuters news agency is reporting that Russia's armed forces have obtained information that the United States and its allies have already decided to launch military action in Iraq from mid-February. The agency's specialist military news wire, AVN, quoting an unnamed high-ranking source in the Russian general staff, said U.S.-led operations would be launched once an attacking force of 150,000 had been assembled in the Gulf. The same unnamed Russian officials say, quote, according to the information we have, the operation is planned for the second half of February. The decision to launch it has been made but not yet been made public, unquote. The source has generally authoritative contacts in the Russian military. The source added that the main aim of the war would be to secure control of Iraqi oil fields. Meanwhile, U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas is taking steps to repeal the congressional resolution granting the president authority to use force in Iraq. Speaking with Peace Watch this afternoon, the congresswoman explains the specifics of her measure.
It's a very simple bill, and I crafted it in a simple style. To appeal to Republicans, independents, and Democrats alike, individuals who I've heard from over the past couple of months who felt that they had not adequately been informed during the debate that occurred in October. A number of us sent a letter to the president before that debate and pleaded with him to allow the members of Congress to go into their districts, to listen to the constituents, to go through the election process and come back to the United States Congress and debate fully with all of the facts. That was not allowed. And so as we debated in early October, unfortunately, information regarding the crisis in North Korea did not come to the United States Congress. So frankly, I believe that we did not have all of the facts necessary to make the appropriate decision using our constitutional responsibility of the declaration of war. And what resulted is, out of the representations that were made, the fear of the American people, the linkage of terrorism, which we now find is not an adequate linkage, we voted to give to the administration unilateral authority to preemptively attack Iraq that had never been done in the history of the United States as relates to the Congress powers to declare war. I frankly believe that people of goodwill, members of goodwill, members who have heard constituents in their district, without any disrespect to the valiant military who now are deployed over to the Iraqi area, who are certainly our first line of defense and our freedom fighters, we should, with all the responsibility that the United States has, we should debate this issue again, and we should have all the facts and make the right decision. Frankly, I believe the decision should be to move toward diplomacy and move toward peace.
Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, have you tested the political waters for this amongst your colleagues in the House and Senate? And is there any reason to expect that Congress might want to change its mind on this matter? There was strong support for the president on October 16th to have these powers when the vote was taken. This is only 3 months later.
The resolution is a provocative resolution, if you will. But if you recall, when we first started debating the war resolution, you could probably put all of the opponents in a telephone booth. We subsequently garnered one-third of the U.S. House of Representatives almost, and almost half of the Democratic caucus, in opposition to the war resolution. We are beginning to send out what we call dear colleague letters to our members of Congress. And this is a vote of conscience. This is a decision of conscience. And we expect that we'll have reasonable support of the idea of allowing us to debate again. We have not presupposed what the debate will result in. We're giving members the opportunity to go to the floor again and express their views now that they've had added facts. One of the confusing points that I think the administration has now developed is that we don't know what the president's foreign policy is as it relates to Iraq. Is it a removal of Saddam Hussein, which we all admit is a bad person or a thug, if you will? Or is it disarmament and the removal of weapons of mass destruction? There is a duplicity, a confusion in the president's position. Frankly, I believe the policy of containment is still a relevant policy. I believe that Iraq is half of the country it was in 1991. We do not have multilateral support as we had in 1991. And in fact, the president's father allowed the Congress to go through its election and actually have the debate in 1991, which would have been the process that would have been preferable. So I would hope my colleagues will listen to the reason of my authoring this legislation. We've already received interest. We already have a number of co-sponsors.
Well, what interest? So, who's your co-sponsor in the Senate, for example?
That process we're working on as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
And we would look forward to raising this question with the Senate. As you well know, we are on recess. And so this legislation was just recently filed, and we expect to work it when we return this coming week.
Do you have the entire Congressional Black Caucus supporting your bill?
Well, as I made known very clearly, this legislation deals with the members of Congress, irrespective of any congressional caucus that they might be in. I am presenting this legislation to members no matter who they are. And frankly, I believe that members will make the decision on their own consciences and beliefs as to the direction of the American people or the direction that this nation should take. I hope that they'll make it on the grounds that we should be more concerned with peace than with violence. And as a nation that is a singular world power, we should be more concerned with promoting that power through promoting peace.
So with all due respect, Congresswoman, is that a no? You don't have the Congressional Black Caucus
supporting it's not a no. This is not a resolution of the Congressional Black Caucus. It is a resolution filed in the United States House of Representatives, and I'm hoping that I will draw the support of all of my colleagues, irrespective of the caucuses that they have, welcoming any caucus or any member that desires to support it. I have not presented this as any kind of caucus action. Remember, I serve in the United States Congress as a representative of the 18th Congressional District, which is a multicultural and multi-diverse district with many points of view, and I'm representing those constituents.
And those constituents, would you characterize that as a fairly liberal district, Congresswoman?
I would characterize it as a wonderfully progressive district
mm-hmm.
that has many perspectives, we have those who have supported the president's position and those who have not. But from the very start, I've been very honest with my constituents to the extent that we've had a town hall meeting, one of the very first, on the Iraqi war resolution before the vote went forward to listen to their views and a prayer vigil. And I was one of the first to hold a full town hall meeting of about 400 people right after 9/11.
Congresswoman, according to a new Washington Post ABC News poll, 7 in 10 Americans would give the U.N. weapons inspectors more months to pursue their arms search. Is it your belief that popular opinion may help to sway your House and Senate colleagues towards passage of this bill repealing the authorization for the use of force against Iraq?
One of the things that I said in announcing this yesterday was that the House is the people's house. And certainly I think that listening to the people of the United States has never posed a wrong-headed decision. And I say that primarily because the people we've seen in the United States when it comes to the issue of foreign policy, peace, and war have good judgment. Certainly, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was able to garner the support of the nation when we knew we had to fight a terror, if you will, in Nazi Germany. I believe, yes, the polls are indicative of people now understanding more, wanting peace, and believing that the U.N. inspectors, but the U.N. Security Council, or the process of the United Nations is a viable process that the United States has consented to and should therefore adhere to.
Would this set a precedent, having such an important resolution repealed like this?
I am always optimistic on what a democracy can engage in. It would, in fact, be unique. Particularly a war resolution. But if I can even generate the kind of discussion on this issue, I think it will cause the president to think through his options and have his advisors reflect on the point that you cannot send young men and women into war unilaterally without a coalition effort in these times, and more particularly with questions being raised by the United States, the people of the United States. We will always support our men and women on the front lines. This is not a criticism of them. This is not an undermining of them. They are already there. They have been deployed. They are there to fight for our freedom. But with the responsibility of power comes the need to use it with great judgment. And I believe the United States now has an opportunity to show judgment and to show its world leadership to the world.
Has Congress abrogated all of its authorities in this war matter, or are there other congressional actions that might be pursued if this bill to repeal is not passed?
Well, we have never given such unilateral authority in a resolution to a president. We didn't give it in 1991. There is a War Powers Act that says that if we are under imminent attack, the president can respond, report back to Congress in 60 days. So we are protected if there is any chance of imminent attack. I believe Americans are more interested in homeland security and national security, which I believe we should focus on, more interested in the multilateral effort to fight terrorism in light of the tragedy that occurred yesterday and the loss of life of one of our citizens in Kuwait. That's the process that we need to engage in. I beg and call upon the president with reason and judgment to begin to engage the American people in national security.
So could, for example, Congress influence troop deployment, or does the commander-in-chief, President Bush, have sole authority at this point?
Right now, the president is a commander-in-chief, and as the resolution reads, he has sole authority with reporting responsibilities back to the United States Congress. And I think that should be questioned. And I am a strong adherent to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and we do have the rights to declare war under the Constitution of the United States.
U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of the 18th District in Houston, Texas. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld found himself in hot water several weeks ago after commenting that military draftees added, quote, no value, no advantage, unquote, to the U.S. military because they serve for shorter periods of time than traditional enlistees. Russell Mokyber of the Corporate Crime Reporter and host of Challenging Corporate Power on Pacifica Station WPFW raised this issue with White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer during a recent press briefing.
Last week, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld said that soldiers drafted to service in the military, quote, added no value, no advantage, really, to the United States Armed Services, unquote. The America Foundation called this an egregious slur and a grave insult to the memory, sacrifice, and valor of those who lost their lives in Vietnam. One Vietnam vet, Thomas Bohan of Rochester, New York, said this, as a draftee who spent a year of his life in Vietnam, I would like to suggest that perhaps my inferior service to our country wouldn't have been necessary if those proud, flag-waving patriots like George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and the rest of the cowards had come forward to enlist. I would like to see Secretary Rumsfeld repeat his speech in front of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial on Memorial Day. Does the president agree with Secretary Rumsfeld that soldiers drafted to service added no value to the United States Armed Services?
Russell, I'm sure that if you took the entire text of what Secretary Rumsfeld said to Secretary Rumsfeld and asked him, and shared with him the entire context of what Secretary Rumsfeld said, you would have thought twice about taking any one statement. I think if you look at everything Secretary Rumsfeld said, you have a very, very different picture.
Rumsfeld later apologized for his statement, but we thought on Peace Watch that we'd check in with Oscar Castro at the American Friends Service Committee's Youth and Militarism Program to get his response, and he's on the line with us now. Mr. Castro, what do you make of Rumsfeld's comments?
Well, you know, it's politics as usual, honestly, and the fact that he had to stand up and apologize for his apparently errant remarks is indicative of the fact that, you know, we're dealing with politicians here who particularly are hawkish in nature.
What about the essence or the content of the statement by Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld that draftees added no value to military service? What do you suppose he was trying to get at with that statement?
Well, the political climate we're in doesn't necessarily demand for a military draft or mandatory military service. And the Department of Defense knows this. They have an all-volunteer military, and they're very proud of it. They know that if they were to initiate a military draft or one were to be called upon, that there'd be inherent challenges in the political climate, and that the Republican Party particularly would be faced with challenges as it relates to the backlash from your, you know, everyday common citizen who is either facing being drafted or enlistment, conscription, or their families, you know, who don't want them to be in conscription. So I think that's the biggest reason for Rumsfeld's commentary. If it were meaningful, they would do it. And at this point, it's not politically meaningful.
Mm-hmm. There is an article in the USA Today that states that contrary to widely held beliefs, American troops likeliest to fight and die in a war against Iraq are disproportionately white, mm-hmm. not black, and it relies on military statistics to support that assertion. Based on your research with the military service and statistics, is that true?
Traditionally, we have the research that would claim otherwise. But one of the points to be made would be, you know, because people are talking about how inequitable the military is and how racist it still is and how segregated it still is. And if those numbers are true, if that statistic is accurate, then the question that has to be asked is, well, what are those people of color who are disproportionately represented in the military doing? And to what degree are they doing it? And are the opportunities there for them to advance in an upwardly mobile sense? Or are they glorified servants for those individuals who would be at the front lines and are, according to that particular statistic, disproportionately white? So, you know, how does that work out, and how does that play into the segregation of the military and the racism that's inherent in the military structure?
Mm. So what are the high-risk jobs? I would assume sort of the fighter pilots in the Air Force, the guys who have to have the right stuff, and the Navy commandos and, I guess, the Navy SEALs, that specialized unit. And in those actual positions, blacks constitute less than 5% of the force.
Right.
So that
right.
that kind of that reflects back to your statement. I can't help wondering, you know, why it is that blacks are not in these lower paying, low risk jobs. Is it that they've chosen them, as this article suggests? The article says they've gravitated towards non-combat jobs that provide skills for post-military careers. Or is it, as you suggest, lingering racism in the military that poses obstacles to them being in those positions?
Well, I think it probably would be both. And the reason being that, you know, for example, if you take a look at what it takes to enter into the Navy SEALs, it's a pretty exclusive club, or to be an Army commando or a ranger. So getting through the filtration process, to be the best warrior that you could be, or the one that's called upon the most, is challenging. And we know that, just like all opportunities in America, that people of color or disenfranchised minorities are going to be the ones who are not going to necessarily always be as adequately prepared to meet those challenges because of their educational or economic disenfranchisement. So we look at the military as just being another social tool to show us an example of where else in our society that takes place. It's hard to say whether or not an individual is actually choosing not to be frontline infantry and deciding to be support doing the laundry or the cooking or fueling of tanks or being a mechanic or what have you. But a lot of those people, unfortunately, will find themselves very close to the front because that's what support is.
Mm-hmm. And when you regard the statistics that blacks still serve disproportionately in the military, making up 12% of the population and 20% of the military, according to this article, then still there is a higher probability that more blacks will be in harm's way, if not necessarily on the front lines.
Exactly, exactly. We know that from the Gulf War, and most of those individuals will be reservists who have been away from active duty for whatever lengthy period of time, are put into a situation where they now have to play the warrior, play the soldier, but in a support capacity. And all we have to do is really watch a few war films to realize that it's not just the individuals who are engaged in a particular battle that are at risk. It's everybody in that region.
Oscar Castro of the American Friends Service Committee Youth and Military Program. Vietnam veteran and actor Ron Kovic offers another veteran's perspective on the impending war with Iraq. He spoke here in the nation's capital last weekend at a press conference announcing last Saturday's anti-war demonstrations organized by the activist group Act Now to Stop War and End Racism.
All the speakers, my fellow citizens who are sitting with me here today and who have had the courage to speak out and who have articulated so forcefully, so truthfully, and so beautifully to you and hopefully to great numbers of people around this country, you are going to begin to hear the real voices, the authentic voices of leadership. What's happening in this country is it is, in a sense, a rebirth of democracy, of real democracy, of people democracy, where the leadership of this country is going to come from the people who live in this country and not from leaders who don't seem to care, don't care about the lives of the American people and the lives of the people, not only in Iraq and in other parts of the world. This is an extraordinary turning point in American history. I think not since the Revolutionary War have we entered a period of such extraordinary change. The potential for change is going to be extraordinary. This movement is not only going to stop this war. This movement, I believe, has every intention of changing the priorities of this government. We intend to change the direction that the United States government is going in, away from brutality, away from killing, away from these unnecessary and immoral and degrading wars that put me in a wheelchair. For the last 35 years, I was shot in Vietnam as a United States Marine. I heard from the podium a few moments ago that the Navy and the Marine Corps were not going to allow the voices of the people, of the citizens of this country that we love. They were not going to allow those voices to be heard. Do you know, in the last couple of weeks, the last few months, they have been trying to silence the voices of the citizens of this country, of the citizens of this country. That this government, in its rush to war, in its rush to dominate the Middle East, in its rush to steal that oil, to take that oil, has done everything that it could possibly do to try to silence the voices of dissent in this country, this so-called democracy. We're going to make this country a democracy. There are citizens who are beginning to become aware that we do not live in an authentic democracy. I think you are going to see extraordinary things begin to happen on the streets of this country. And these events are going to be nonviolent. In the spirit of Dr. King, they're going to be dignified. They're going to be about a people who know what it means to live with the wounds of this society, of people who have suffered for a long time and who now understand that the representatives are not going to help us. The senators and the congressmen have all voted for the war, almost entirely. The so-called leadership in this country has failed the American people. This is going to be an extraordinary year. And what is happening, I think, the antithesis of that feeling in this country after September 11th, that feeling that someone, I remember, was it the vice president who said, be careful what you say, be careful what you speak. I think you're going to see, you're going to witness people beginning to speak from their hearts because they know in their hearts that there is something desperately wrong with this country right now, that the president of the United States, his policy in Iraq is one of the greatest threats to our national security. Do you want to know what is threatening our national security? This war will put the people that we love, our people, our fellow citizens, our mothers and our fathers. This war, this president's war, will make us even greater targets of terror than ever before. This war will bring on a firestorm of terror against us. This is not the way to go. This violence is not the answer. This killing is not the answer. They tried to use me and my generation to kill and to fight for them, but we learned. But we have found strength and hope and faith, and we are beginning to believe that we can change this country, that this movement can become a very powerful movement, that hundreds and hundreds of thousands and even greater numbers of citizens of this country will begin to go to the streets with nonviolence and with dignity. This is a nonviolent movement, but this is an extremely determined movement of citizens and people who are fed up and sick and tired and who are ready to change this country because no one has changed it up until now. And now they know. Now they know because this is life and death. This president is leading us toward a war that will threaten our lives, will put our lives in even greater danger. We have an obligation. We have a responsibility to ourselves, to our loved ones, to the people of this country, and to the people of the world to protect the peace by stopping the direction that this president is leading our country in, because it is a reckless direction, a dangerous direction, a foolhardy direction. We are well aware that this war can only cause us more sorrow, more suffering as a nation, as a people. We will go to the streets in great numbers in the coming weeks and months, and we will make history, because we must make history. We must be willing to sacrifice. We must be willing to serve as a people, as citizens. We must participate. We must have the courage, and find that courage if we don't have it, to step over the line, to say enough, and to say, this country is our country. We love this country. We are sick and tired of the way this country has been represented. We are sick and tired of the way other people view us as a people. They have soiled our name. They have taken the good name of the people of this beautiful, beautiful country. They have taken the name of the people of this country, and they have run it through the mud. And we are going to take this country back because it belongs to us. And we will create a beautiful country, a country we can be proud of, a country that the rest of the world will look upon and say, there are good people. There were people, a reasonable people, a kind people, a compassionate people, because we are a beautiful people. And we who sit here before you, we know that this is a great country. We know this is a beautiful country. We feel the potential of this country. You are going to see the potential of this country on the streets of this country, on the streets of the cities of this country. You are going to see not only a great movement, but you are going to see a society change, and you are going to see history. This is the beginning.
Ron Kovic is a Vietnam veteran, former Marine Corps sergeant, and author of Born on the 4th of July. He was paralyzed from his chest down while serving in combat in Vietnam and has been in a wheelchair ever since. He continues to work for peace. He was awarded the Purple Heart. Thanks to Peace Watch producer Reem Kathuda for producing that segment. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.